Okay, well, let's call Wooten versus BNSF Railway Company. If counsel for the appellant is ready to go, we'll hear from you.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. Jacqueline Holmes for the appellant, BNSF Railway Company. May it please the court. In the interest of time this morning, I'd like to begin briefly by discussing two damages-related issues, that is front pay and the failure to instruct on the good faith defense to punitive damages, and then I will turn to the merits. The front pay award in this case is unprecedented. The district court awarded $1.4 million in front pay, which is right between what Wooten's expert calculated as a 30-year front pay award of $1.33 million and what the expert, again, Mr. Wooten's expert, calculated as a front pay award of for 37 years, which was $1.55 million. So we've got somewhere between a 30 and a 37-year front pay award.
Ma'am, this is Judge Pregerson. Can I ask you a question?
Of course, Judge.
So you say it's unprecedented, but did BNSF do anything during the trial by way of presenting any evidence at all that the assumptions that the expert used were incorrect?
So in terms of the, I don't think we disputed the math, Judge Pregerson, and the math is
No, that's not my question. That's not my question. You didn't dispute the math. You didn't dispute the assumptions other than you cross-examined the plaintiff's experts. You did not present any underlying evidence that would dispute the basic assumptions about the availability of comparable work, of being able to earn a comparable salary through other opportunities. You presented no affirmative evidence at all about the marketplace in Whitefish. You did not present any expert testimony in that regard. Isn't that correct?
So I don't think that's entirely correct, Judge Pregerson. I understand your point, but I do think that there was evidence.
No, I think it is. I think it is entirely correct, and I think it's a key point. I think you're asking this court, arguably, to rescue BNSF from not conducting a vigorous defense and contesting these issues. So tell me why I'm wrong.
So for a few reasons. So first of all, Mr. Wooten has the burden on damages, not the BNSF. That's number one.
Well, of course, and he put forth evidence.
He did put forth evidence, but I would argue that that evidence does not support the length of a...
Could you answer my first question? Did BNSF hire an expert?
So I believe BNSF did have a vocational expert who testified as to the availability of other jobs in the railroad jobs and otherwise, and they also cross-examined. If I'm wrong about that, I apologize, but I believe that's correct, that there was an expert that BNSF presented. But that aside, again, there are two fundamental assumptions underlying the front pay award here. The first is that had he not been dismissed, Mr. Wooten would have stayed at BNSF for 30 years. That assumption, the only record evidence that really supports that or arguably supports that is Mr. Wooten's own subjective belief and his own subjective testimony that he wanted to stay for that length.
So what more was he required to see? Now you're making a legal argument. You're not making a factual one. You're making an argument that the evidence was insufficient to support the judge's eventual determination that he would have remained there for 30 years. What more should he have introduced in your view? He said, gee, my father worked here all his life. I intend to work here all my life too. What more should he have introduced? If to meet his burden in your view, what else should he have done?
So I think, Judge, he could have done more in terms of...
Well, he could have done a lot more. My question is, what does the law require that he do?
So I guess what I would say is, if you look at the Payton case, admittedly from the D.C. Circuit and not this circuit, but it's the closest one factually I could find. The court there held very clearly that employees' subjective intent, no matter how sincerely held, is not sufficient to establish that he or she will stay at a job for decades. And there's a reason for that. That actually makes a lot of sense because there are market forces and technological changes that impact us and that impact every industry, right?
Okay, I understand all that, but you still haven't responded to my question. Tell me what, certainly his subjective intent in staying is a factor. If he said, I was only going to stay here for another 2 years, he'd only get another 2 years of front pay. So what, in addition to his subjective intent, because you put on no case, you only cross-examined his, and now you're saying his case was insufficient. Tell me what more he was required to put on, in your view, to make his case a sufficient case for front pay.
I think in addition to his, there had to be some objective evidence that that was a reasonable assumption.
Okay, tell me what that was. How does a plaintiff meet that burden?
He could have taken discovery, for example, on how long folks typically stay in the jobs. That's one thing he could have done, and he could have put that on. I think the underlying point is there has to be some objective evidence beyond the subjective intent, because there is a market forces issue here, right? And you cannot sit and assume that the world is going to be the same 30 years from now as it is today. That's the bottom line.
I'm sorry, it's Judge Pregerson. I hope I'm not interrupting.
No problem.
But isn't the market forces argument a double-edged sword? I mean, you know, to get a job that pays $100,000 in Montana seems like a pretty unusual situation. And if that's true, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, it seems like that certainly cuts against the argument that he was likely to leave, and therefore lends credibility to his argument that this was this, you know, great job, and, for a guy that only had a high school education, I wasn't going to be able to make, you know, more money than that great job doing something else.
So Judge Pregerson, it certainly cuts against the notion that he would leave voluntarily. But the bottom line is there are no guarantees that he would not be required to leave involuntarily. I'll give you an example. 30 years ago, the Class I railroads in this country employed 400,000 people. Today, that number is 120,000. Things change. And
so did you make those arguments to the jury, and did your expert argue those issues? I'm sorry, you didn't have an expert. Did you make the arguments that you're now raising on appeal in a factual way before the jury?
So I believe that the company did argue that there were no guarantees going forward in the future. But again, the reality is...
you're complaining about the lack of empirical data. And I'm asking you whether you did a sufficient job in the trial.
And I take your point, Judge Pregerson. And all I think I can tell you is that in the end, the evidence of record has to support the award of front pay. And here, the evidence of record does not. Merely saying, I want to stay, is not enough. And it should be enough.
Your argument is that the plaintiff has an affirmative burden, if he wants front pay for over a period of time, to demonstrate that it's more probable than not that he would be employed over that period of time?
At a minimum, to demonstrate that there's, sure, because, and I'm not sure if more probable than not is the exact standard, Judge, to be candid. But look, damages have to be grounded in fact. They can't be based on a guess. This is a guess. And this circuit I'm sorry, Judge Pregerson.
I'm sorry. That's fine. Except we enter default judgments all the time. You know, lawyers don't always do a great job. I keep coming back to the fact that, whatever wounds you're complaining about now were self-inflicted. And just tell me why I'm wrong.
And again, I think the best I can say is that he has the burden on damages. We do not have the burden on damages. He has to demonstrate that he had a reasonable probability, that it's more than a guess to say that he would be with us for 30 years. And he hasn't done that. Subjective intent does not do that and shouldn't do that. Remember,
and market forces don't matter, and the availability of this plum job doesn't matter, and his family history doesn't matter.
I don't think, again, alone, subjective intent is enough, because market forces do matter, right? I think I agree with you that market forces matter. Absolutely. And moreover, so the second assumption underlying all this is that he's going to sit in place in his current job and never make any more money. And the record doesn't support that. He said himself he wasn't sure whether he would remain in the job. His expert testified to his academic abilities. His expert testified to other certificates he had the ability to obtain in order to earn more money, and the fact and to the possibility that he could one day own an agency. And so if you look at all of that, again, what this court fundamentally has said about front pay is that it has to be temporary. And taking someone, bearing in mind that the amount of front pay in this case was six times as long as he'd worked for BNSF and 3 years longer than he'd been alive at the time he was fired. So that's a very, very long time. And if you look at that and you track that out, it's quite clear that is not, it's not temporary, right? It's permanent. It's the opposite of temporary, because you've taken a 30-year-old and you've bridged him all the way to retirement. It's the definition of permanent. So for those reasons, I think the front pay does not comply with the law of the circuit, and that for that reason it should be vacated.
There's not much law of this circuit, as I think the briefs indicate. If we were to make law of this circuit to control front pay, the evidence needed to get front pay awards, is there some circuit's law that you suggest is the appropriate law to look to?
So I don't know that there's a particular circuit. As I said, I think the closest case that I found is the Payton case from the D.C. Circuit, which indicated, again, as I said, that the subjective intent is not enough to bridge someone to retirement. If you look also at the case law as a whole, it is extraordinarily rare, if ever, to bridge a 40-year-old to retirement, much less a 30-year-old to retirement for front pay. Again, bearing in mind that it's an equitable remedy, right? Another thing I'd like to say on this, just to be clear. So what the statutory text says here is that the damages award is supposed to make the employee whole. This damages award does far more than that, because it insulates Mr. Wooten from all market forces, technological changes in the railroad industry, et cetera, and guarantees him a 4% annual increase for the rest of his career. Somebody working for BNSF today does not have those guarantees.
It's like he was a federal judge.
So it goes far beyond what is required under the statute to make Mr. Wooten whole. Shifting, if I can, if there are no further questions on that, to the failure to instruct on the good faith defense for punitive damages. I think this raises two questions. And the first is whether the Polstad defense applies under the FRSA at all. And if so, whether it was reversible error to refuse to give it here. And I think the answer to both of those questions is yes. It is true that the Ninth Circuit has not ruled one way or the other whether the good faith defense to punitive damages is a defense under the FRSA. It's not been called upon to do so, and it hasn't. The cases and the circuits that have been called upon to answer that question have answered it affirmatively. So the Eighth Circuit in the BNSF versus Department of Labor case applied the good faith defense to hold there that there should be no punitive damages as a matter of law. And the Department of Labor's Administrative Review Board, which is the last word within the Department of Labor on these issues, has also held that the good faith defense applies.
Assume that it does. Assume that it does, that the Kolstad instruction is appropriate. And the facts of this case, is it appropriate? It appears that lots of senior level officials in the company were involved in the dismissal decision here. If the president of the company decided to fire him, would the Kolstad instruction be appropriate?
So I think if it were at that level, if it were the CEO, perhaps not. I think.
Well, here we have at least evidence, the director of administration for Montana, the director of labor relations, the Montana division general manager, and the regional vice president were all involved. So it wasn't like some supervisor just made a decision to fire him. And
that's right, Judge. And I think that's part of the point, right? That there is oversight built into this, and that could be viewed by a jury. a fair jury as evidence that BNSF is making good faith efforts to prevent retaliation, right? They're not just letting their managers go off and do things willy-nilly. Now, I want to be clear, though, the director of a director in labor relations is not the top person in labor relations. It is somebody who, again, on the facts under how BNSF system works, it's not the very top person.
Right. But Johnson and Johnson talks about somebody said that the rule doesn't do away with the notion that the corporation is responsible for the decision of somebody sufficiently senior.
It does. And I think it also says that that is, generally speaking, a question of fact. So I think that's something that should have gone, that could have gone to the jury. The jury certainly could have been instructed that if they determined that these folks were sufficiently senior, that the defense didn't apply. But that doesn't mean that the defense doesn't apply out of the gate. Again, here you have very clear evidence of anti-retaliation policies. You have evidence of training. You have evidence of, again, senior oversight, which is in many ways a good thing, right? Obviously, everyone disputes here whether that worked, but that's not the question. The question is whether there are enough facts in this record to raise a fact issue on that should have gone to the jury on the good faith defense. And I think there clearly are. I don't think that the individuals involved are so senior, particularly.
How about the regional vice president?
Yeah, I don't think that is sufficiently senior as a matter of law, and I don't know.
Well, the regional, but sorry, Judge Gregerson, the regional vice president was involved as well. That doesn't strike you as sufficiently senior.
It doesn't. Particularly because Judge Gregerson.
And what about the law department being involved as well? That's in the record.
It is in the record, yes. But again, I think a jury could just as easily have viewed that as evidence of BNSF's good faith efforts to comply.
So do you think a jury gets to decide whether the person is sufficiently senior? Or is that a legal question?
I think it's probably a mixed question of law and fact, Judge, but I confess I haven't thought about it in a lot of detail. The reality here is the judge didn't make that determination. He just said, I'm not giving the instruction. And he didn't say why. He didn't say...
But you wouldn't be entitled to the instruction under our case law if a person sufficiently senior in the corporation had made these decisions. And so my question is, can't we find as a matter of law that the regional vice president or the Montana division general manager are sufficiently senior?
I don't think that would be the right outcome, but I think theoretically, yes. I mean, of course, theoretically, you could determine that. But bear in mind that if that happens, then what you're doing is discouraging BNSF from exercising this oversight. Because what you're telling them is, if you exercise oversight, you're not going to have a defense to punitive damages.
And that's what we're telling them, I guess, is assuming that this firing was outrageous, what we're saying is that if a senior person approves outrageous determinations, you're not going to have a good faith defense.
And again, of course, the company doesn't view it as outrageous. And
yeah, I understand.
Okay. In any event, I do think that in this case, it was appropriate to give a Kolstad instruction, and the district court erred by refusing to do so.
I was just going to say you're down to 2 minutes, but do you have another? And you covered both issues. You said you wanted to be sure to cover. What else do you want to tell us about?
So. I would like to speak to the merits, but obviously there's a lot there, so I will just try to be brief about it, and of course answer any questions. I think the problem in this case is that it's difficult to believe, at least in my view, that the jury could possibly have gotten this right, given the fact that the two claims were tried together and that certain instructions, particularly as to honest belief and business judgment, which were clearly correct statements of the law, were not given. The FELA injury case asked the jury to decide what actually happened in the case, what actually happened with regard to the injury, how it happened, whether it happened at work or not, through the lens of several years of investigation and with the benefit of experts.
Counsel, can I ask you one question on this? This goes to the bifurcation issue. So was the company envisioning impaneling two totally separate juries to hear the evidence on each claim?
Yes.
Okay. That just makes to me no sense given the the amount of overlap, how we would say that that was an abuse of discretion by the district court to deny that just strikes me as well beyond anything I'd be prepared to say.
And I understand and I appreciate that, Judge Watford. I think the reason, though, that we think that it was is because there was prejudice to BNSF in the end, because it is impossible to believe that a jury, and this is with all respect to the jury, I want to be clear, right? I'm not blaming the jury here, but it's impossible to believe that a jury composed who has just decided what actually happened with regard to the FVLA case, then can turn around and forget about that and set it to the side completely, which is what they would have to do this fairly, and look through the perspective of BNSF management to see what information they had in front of them and whether they honestly believed that there was that Mr. Wooten was lying based on the information they had in front of them.
But then what you're arguing, it seems to me, is that when these two kinds of claims come together, the judge has no discretion except to separate them.
I don't think that's quite what I'm saying. I think in this type of case, it was important. And I think, again, I might be having a different discussion with you if the honest belief instructions were given and the business judgment instructions were given, because I think that would have at least helped the jury understand the legal framework. And the whole premise of not bifurcating this case was that a whole of these instructions were going to be given that then really weren't given, right? So I think that's I'm not saying the judge has no discretion. I'm also not saying, by the way, that this is the case in every FELA, FRSA case. That's not what I mean. But I think here where the question is it involves a false injury report and an FELA claim, you're asking the jury to decide with regard to the FELA claim what actually happened. And then you're turning around and you're asking the jury to decide, on the other hand, what the company honestly believed. And that's really tough to get right. It is. And I don't think the instructions here give any confidence that the jury did get it right.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll give you a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Let's hear from counsel for the plaintiff.
Thank you, Your Honors. On behalf of Mr. Wooten, my name is Bill Jungbauer. And I think at the outset, I would like to, as an overview, request that the court review the case of DeFrancesco that has been cited. And the reason I mentioned that is that case, DeFrancesco v. UP. And the reason that's so important is under this whole statutory framework, these cases start out under OSHA.
Can I ask you, counsel, which issue are you focused on initially?
Initially, that was an overview. The issue I'll focus on initially, Your Honors, I'll go back to the issues that counsel brought up. And I'll say that I disagree with her, first of all, on the necessity of the Kolstad instruction. Number one, I think the trial court, in its opinion, got it right that in this jurisdiction, in the Ninth Circuit, the Kolstad instruction has not been found to apply to FRSA cases. More importantly, what the judge did is he took the Ninth Circuit instruction, used it, which has most of the operative language of the Kolstad instruction. But most importantly, in addition to that, is the decision makers that BNSF identify in their brief. And I don't necessarily agree that BNSF gets to identify as a matter of law who decision makers are. But going beyond that, they have identified to this court that Ms. Maglescu, Mr. Franzen, and I believe the VP were decision makers. Well, the item to know here, the key fact, is that the accident report was one of the exhibits to the investigation that was forwarded to Ms. Maglescu. There is, and Mr. Franzen also reviewed it, there is no dispute that the decision makers in this case were aware of the protected activity. So that's why Kolstad, frankly, the whole issue of there is irrelevant here, because it's already admitted that the decision makers designated by the railroad, who are the ones high enough up to review this, had knowledge of the protected activity. And in addition to what the court has said, not only that, but Ms. Magliscu then presented evidence to the what's called PEPA board. And what the PEPA board is the COO, the number two person at BNSF, plus a bunch of executive vice presidents who review her findings. It can't get any higher than that. But what the railroad has set up itself for its hierarchy of decision makers, of those with authority to make these decisions, is that someone like Ms. Magliscu, someone like Mr. Franzen, who is the top operating officer for the Montana division. That's his, and then Mr. Randall, the VP who oversees him, that's as high as it gets. There's nothing higher for their whole system that they've set up. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I would point out that if a close reading of Kolstad, and I read it a number of times, mm-hmm. I had some trouble with it because Kolstad, as you know, the different justices shifted around from the first part to the second part, but most importantly on on the part 2B of that opinion, where they're talking about this whole issue. They make a decision and say, we're not going to follow the restatement of agency because we're going to make special adaptations for the intentions of this law. And thus, for something to apply to the FRSA, we really need to look at the FRSA. And the FRSA, again, if we look specifically at the statute, what it provides for is, it's very specific. It says under Part A, a railroad carrier engaged in interstate or foreign commerce, a contractor or subcontractor of a railroad carrier, or an officer or employee of such railroad carrier may not discharge, demote, suspend, reprimand, or in any other way discriminate against an employee if such discrimination is due in whole or in part to the employee's lawful good faith act done or perceived by the employer to have been done or about to be done. The reason that's important, that language, is this good faith belief is a misstatement of law under the FRSA because it's only the plaintiff's belief, good faith belief, that has anything to do with this statute if we read it. And so the whole issue about how and under what circumstances a railroad should be held not to be liable for damages comes under their under the burden of proof section, where which is the been brought up by 42121. Which shows under part two, notwithstanding a finding by the secretary that the complainant has made a showing required under clause one, no investigation otherwise required under subpart A shall be conducted if the employer demonstrates by clear and convincing evidence that the employer would have taken the same unfavorable personnel action in the absence of that behavior.
We're talking here about a punitive damages instruction, not a compensatory damages instruction.
Yes.
And so is it your position is that there's something in the FSRA which means we shouldn't import the Kolstad instruction into it for punitive damages? And if so, what is there?
If you import the Kolstad instruction and give the operative language and compare that to the instructions this court gave, they're the same. The only part of the Kolstad instruction is the question of whether or not, under agency theory, the decision makers in this case were high enough to bind the corporation. If you look at the Palantino case from this circuit,
And that's the case that we were talking about, Johnson & Johnson.
Yes. If you look at that, they go into that and they do a good analysis that I think supports the analysis of the trial court in this case. So I don't think that the instruction, the Kolstad instruction itself, can be brought over unless we look at the purposes and objectives of the FRSA as compared to Title VII, and they are different, because the FRSA specifically says don't fire somebody for turning in an accident report. And that is if you read again that DeFrancesco case I was reporting, that identifies the fact that OSHA considers the filing of an accident report to be, I'd like to find their exact language, almost like a super protected right, because it's so important and so basic to the reasons and purposes of the FRSA. So that, in this type of case with these facts, to have an employee turn in an accident report and then be fired for it. And if we go back to the, so under Kolstad, we know we've got the right person. We don't have to have a separate instruction because BNSF has already identified who the management people are sufficient to make these decisions under their process.
Can I ask you to, because I know you've got limited time, address the front pay award for me. And yes. let me just give you an overview. And I agree with almost everything that Judge Pragerson said before about the absence of contrary evidence in the record. But this appears to be the longest front pay award in any reported case in the United States. And if it's not, it's darn close. And well, it's 30 years for a relatively young man, and it's as if he had tenure at a major university. So tell me, I mean, at some point, isn't some number of years just too long?
Well, Your Honor, that is the evidence that the court heard was not just the intention of the plaintiff. The evidence, as was brought out, is that he was accumulating seniority, and seniority is like tenure. The more seniority you get as a railroad worker, you can work for better paying, better conditioned jobs. He loved the job and intended to want to work there. There was no evidence from the vocational lady called by the by BNSF. No one disputed that he was going to and had the capacity to work to retirement. His grandfather had done it. He was doing it. And there was no dispute. And the reason, as counsel used the term market forces, under market forces, where is a guy with a high school education going to get a $100,000 a year job from an employer that has to have him to survive? And
what was the evidence on that latter point? What was the evidence that the employer has to have your guy as opposed to someone doing his job?
Well, Your Honor, it's seniority. The seniority system, somebody doing his job, it's the evidence was that vocational experts, our vocational experts said that he had a work life expectancy of, you know, between 60 and 67. And she's got experience having looked at all of this and the not only the seniority protections, but the ability of him to do the job. He had no prior discipline of any type. And so, and the other thing to show that this was a fair and reasoned front pay award, working at the insurance agency, the boss of that insurance agency testified, and he said that the numbers that we used were accurate and reasonable for somebody with his ability and his credentials in the industry. The owner said that even though he was thinking of retiring, he couldn't sell or give his business to Mr. Wooten, so there's no reasonable expectation that Wooten was going to be able to even keep that job that he has. But we deducted that amount for the whole time. And I'm sorry that it's 4 years, but they fired a guy, and if we had gotten into statistics, we could have shown how long railroad workers work, but it was undisputed. They had their vocational lady who didn't say it's speculative. And for any jobs that the vocational lady for the railroad came up, we asked her, can you tell us, is it reasonable to expect he'd actually be able to be placed or get one of those jobs? And she wasn't able to do that. So their whole deduction for mitigation was speculative. Ours, we made a deduction and assumed the job he could get, which our expert says was the best one in that economy that he could get. That's why it's fair.
Right. I wasn't. Let me just be more specific. I'm not questioning in my question now the other job in the comparison. What I'm questioning is, because front pay is supposed to be a temporary remedy, does there come a point in time where a court should just not allow it to go on for the rest of somebody's working life over 30 years?
Well, Your Honor, Judge Christensen actually addressed that. And when he says, when he went through his whole discussion of whether this is a legal or equitable remedy, in his opinion.
Right. And he said, I think it's equitable, so I better rule. Because if it was legal, I would have left it up to the jury.
Well, but I think he's right. And the reason he's right is because to give full enforcement to the intent of Congress and this statute, it says that the purpose is to make the employee whole. How do we make him whole if he's got a $40,000 a year deficit in what he can earn anywhere in the state of Montana based on the evidence before the jury? We can't. And so the only way, even giving the benefit to the railroad of assuming he's going to have that insurance job forever, he's got that loss. It's a demonstrated loss. And that doesn't even build in, and the different percentages that were built in by the economist was based on historical numbers. And he also did a reduction of present value based on interest rates that someone could earn, which might be laughable in today's world, because we know that you can't count on so much interest. But so the real deal is to give full effect to the intent of Congress. This needs to be done. And if you read the statute, again, under the remedies, what it says, under the statute is the types of damages that an employee can recover. But it says in the very beginning, under Part 1, an employee prevailing in an action under subsection D shall be entitled to all relief necessary to make the employee whole.
Is Judge Pregerson, isn't the concept that it's meant to be equivalent of reinstatement, and that the railroad rejected reinstatement?
Yes, and it is, and that's what the court found. And in fact, if they'd reinstated him, you know, this would be, we might not be here. But they didn't want to reinstate him, and because of the animosity that was shown, where the railroad continually, all of these officials called him a liar in front of his family who were in the court. They publicly said he's a liar, and they're not going to take him back and treat him when they've got rules that they can interpret however they want to. They could fire him for being immoral. They could fire him for being dishonest with no definition of dishonesty. They've got so many of these general vague rules, which is another whole problem, but it's not reasonable to expect that, A, they would take him back, or B, that if he went back, that they wouldn't do it again to him, and he wouldn't be able to work there.
Can you go back for a second, because this is useful to me, and tell me again what evidence besides his testimony that he would remain there supports the judge's determination that he would remain in this job for 30 years?
Again, and I'm kind of doing this off the top of my head, his testimony not only of intent, his testimony of the other workers that he knew personally had been there their whole life, in other words, his grandfather, that his grandfather had provided a good life for his family through that job, that he wanted to provide a good life for his family through the same type of job.
Let me ask a more specific question. What was the record evidence about seniority and its effect?
There was testimony, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, Your Honor.
Because I didn't, in going through the record, I didn't find anything that said because he was senior, he was entitled to stay.
Well, you're entitled. What seniority does in a union is you can't be, you're not an at-will employee. You can't be let go for no reason.
Okay. And yeah, so tell me what's in the record about that. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
All I can recall and say honestly is that he was a seniority. We described seniority system, how it works, that the more seniority you get, the better jobs you can get, and the more pay and the more preferable jobs you'll have.
What was the evidence? Let me ask a more specific question. What was the evidence in the record, if any, about the effect of his union membership on the ability of the railroad to terminate him? I take it they can only terminate him for cause, right?
Yes, or under their procedures. Yeah, it's not an at-will. It's not an at-will position.
Okay, but I mean, obviously they could have layoffs. That's another issue. Well, but was there anything in the record about that? Is what I'm asking.
Without going back and looking, I assume so. I believe so, and I'd have to go look, Your Honor, because I wasn't asked. Because that is such a thing that if they had raised the issue, we would have got statistics from the Rare Retirement Board of how long these guys work based on their actuarial tables. We didn't need it, but we would have had it. I mean, railroad workers on average work longer than almost anybody else in the same industry in the country. That specific statement wasn't made, but we all know it, which is why it wasn't disputed by the railroad or their experts. When our guy has when the plaintiff makes the affirmative statement, I'm going to work this long, when the economist relies on that, and when the vocational person for us says, yes, he's going to work that, we believe he'll work that long because that's the best job he could get with his education, training, and experience. That under the market force argument that counsel's made shows that he more likely than not would have. And the economist's testimony, if you go back to that, you will see what all he relied on and why he did it. I mean, he looked at all of these items and was subject to cross-examination. And if there was something in the record that counsel could point to, I believe it'd be in the record to show that how long he was going to work was an issue. That wasn't even an issue in the case. What they did say is that he shouldn't get a 40-year, quote, annuity. And it's not an annuity. It's what the loss to him is. If they could show or would have shown that it's more likely than not that he could have got a job to earn more money doing anything else, it would have been in the record and you would see it. The best job he could get was the railroad job. The second best job in the record that he could get now or in the future was the insurance job. That's the evidence.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You're well over your time now.
I'm sorry about that.
No, you were answering our questions very helpfully. Thank you. Let's put 2 minutes on the clock for rebuttal for counsel for the railroad.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly. So first on Kolstad, I would note that in the Pasatino case, the Johnson & Johnson case, one of the employees at issue was a vice president of sales. and the court found that it was, and another one was an employee who was the head of the office where the plaintiff worked. And those individuals were not held as a matter of law to be sufficiently senior that they should, that they would ultimately prevent the good faith defense. In fact, the court remanded for further fact finding on that. So that's point one on Pasatino. Another point, though, that I think is important here is we don't know, based on the instructions that were given, what level of employee the jury found acted with malice. We don't know. We don't know if they found that it was the VP or if they found that it was James Pino, who ran a single site within Montana in BNSF's 32,000-mile system. And the reason we don't know that is because they weren't specifically asked that question, of course, but we also don't know that because no Kolstad good faith defense instruction was given. And had it been given, and of course the jury could have been instructed on the sufficiently senior point, then we would know, right? So I think that's on Kolstad. And then on front pay, all I would say is that what you have here is fundamentally a subjective intent to stay in the job, which is not and should not be enough to grant a 30-year-old 30 years of front pay. Again, this court has been clear that front pay is supposed to be temporary. This is the opposite of temporary. Even in Gotthard, where you were awarded 11 years of front pay under very specific circumstances, the court noted that that was generous.
Are there circumstances that you can envision in which somebody would be entitled to a 30-year front pay award?
As an equitable matter, probably not, Judge. But if I think there, if, I think if there were such, it would be more along the lines of what you see in Gotthard, where you had somebody who was unable to work because of the employer's misconduct. Right, they were physically unable to work because in that case the employee had PTSD and she was bridged to retirement for 11 years. Something the court that called generous and that was 30% of what Mr. Wooten got here. Where and he's an able-bodied individual who has high abilities, right? He scored very highly, highest possible scores on the aptitude test that his expert administered. So it's completely not comparable. In the Bohm case, another example, the court awarded 6 years of front pay and said that that was longer than is generally awarded under federal discrimination laws. Here right. were five
but
times
I, that. I mean, boiled down, I guess I understand your argument just to be that pretty much as a legal matter, as a matter of law, 30 years is just too long, no matter really what the circumstances are, because, I don't know, it's just too speculative to game out that far into the future.
So I do think that's right, Judge, but I would caveat it with, on this record, with an able-bodied 30-year-old, et cetera, it's simply not warranted.
Well, I guess the reason I'm asking that is it seems to me if we were ever going to uphold a 30-year front pay award, the facts in this case are pretty damn strong for the plaintiff. The only other thing, I suppose, that the plaintiff could have put on was some kind of statistical evidence about, you know, how often do folks at his age, in fact, remain with the same railroad for the rest of their career? You know, maybe it would be a high number, maybe it wouldn't. But short of that, I don't really know what else from an economic standpoint you could put on to persuade a jury or to persuade a judge sitting in equity that this is a pretty good prediction. I mean, we can game out pretty with a fair degree of assurance as to what the rest of this person's working career would have looked like.
So I think you can game it out in terms of the math, right? But I don't think you can game it out in terms of what the industry is going to look like. Your guess, it's a guess as to what the industry is going to look like 30 years from now. It's a guess as to
what. But aren't you then just asking judges to get involved and sort of micromanage these trials on economic issues, second-guess juries, second-guess judges? You know, I mean, really what you're saying is draw a bright line somewhere. And this is just too far because it is.
I don't think it's because it is, Judge. I think it's because, again, it's a guess. The math.
Well, but isn't it always a guess? I mean, even when you have experts speculating or testifying or opining, it's always a guess. So what if you were a college and he were a tenured professor and he were 30 years old and he wanted to stay there until he was 65? would he then be required to put in evidence that, gee, sometimes colleges fail or departments get reorganized? And I mean, I'm trying to figure out what evidence you, I take it your point is really that no amount of evidence would justify a 30-year award. It's not that he failed to put in the appropriate evidence. It's just that no amount of evidence could ever justify it.
So no amount of evidence ever has, I think, to the point.
But there's been a 27 out there.
That's right, although that was under state law. That wasn't a federal claim, right? And it wasn't to a 30-year-old. Again, if the notion that front pay is supposed to be temporary means anything, this is out of bounds. If it doesn't mean anything, then I guess we can say that. But if the notion that it's supposed to be tempered to avoid windfall and it's supposed to be temporary means anything, then it shouldn't be upheld here.
If it were a 10-year award, would you have the same arguments?
I haven't thought through the exact point at which, I mean, I might make the same arguments because certainly 1 to 3 years is the norm and it's the typical, especially, again, the only federal case, the only Ninth Circuit case I know of, and it's a federal claim, is Gotthard, which was 11, but which the court really focused on very specific circumstances. You had a 59-year-old who they bridged to retirement, and they did it because she had been at the railroad longer than Mr. Wooten had, 8 or 9 years. So it was roughly comparable to the length of time she'd worked there. And she had post-traumatic stress disorder that was specifically caused by the railroad's conduct. Those were the findings in the case, right? And there, the court, I think, with some reluctance, I mean, said, look, it's generous, but we're going to do it in this case on these facts. You don't have anything like that here.
But doesn't it sort of come back to this problem that, you know, it invites gamesmanship the other way also, where the railroad says, look, we're not going to put on any evidence at all disputing what the long-term employment status is of people. We're not even going to do that because we don't like it. And we'll just do nothing or put on a minimal case, and then we'll argue that it's excessive as a matter of law. I mean, isn't that of equal concern to your argument that, you know, that it's too, quote, speculative or too long?
So, Judge, I guess what I would say about that is there's always some risk when one party has the burden of proof and the other one and another one doesn't, that the one party will.
But couldn't you have eliminated that burden of proof issue by putting on evidence?
Potentially. I mean, certainly, perhaps the railroad could have put on more evidence here than it did. But I don't think that answers the question, right, which is whether or not fundamentally we're going to allow a 30-year-old to be bridged all the way to retirement for 30-plus years of front pay as an equitable remedy. Again, no court's ever done it that I know of.
But we do things like that all the time, where we speculate about the length of injuries, the length of employment. I mean, we do the best we can with the evidence that we're presented with. And I guess I just am unaware of any way that we would formulate a bright line on these issues, other than sending something back and saying, well, we don't like it, try again.
And I guess to say there's an absolute bright line, it's X years or Y years, maybe that is difficult. But the reality is that here, the only evidence supporting the length of time is subjective intent. And that can't possibly be enough.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank
we appreciate the arguments from both counsel in this case. The case just argued is submitted, and we are in recess for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.